One time I left San Francisco Zen Center or Green Gulch Farm where I was living for many years, and I took a maybe half year kind of off and was practicing outside the community like that. And you know, it's interesting practicing without a sangha, a community to practice with. It's different. I think there's many great things about practicing with community, but one of them is people kind of keep us grounded, and people give us kind of reality checks, right? Just by hanging around people. And I wasn't hanging around practitioners for a while. And I remember I was practicing, but maybe my view of my own practice was getting a little bit askew, but there was no reality check. And I thought that I was doing pretty well. I thought that I was in a really good space where it's like, I feel actually really free and like, can't think of much that could bother me these days. And I was walking down the road in that state one day. Maybe a kind of hidden pride or arrogance and just being so invincible. And I remember this, cars were driving by, and I don't know if it was like the way I was walking, if I was emanating this vibe of arrogance or something. But like, I remember looking up in this one car, like some, maybe it was kids, I don't remember, but people in the back window of the car made this face at me, like kind of sort of a teasing face, maybe a little bit of a scowl, a judgmental face, a kind of poking fun face, just for a glimpse of this face I saw in the window. And it was like popping a balloon, my sense of well-being and invincibility suddenly deflated, and I became like intensely like ashamed for no particular reason. I think it's just because I've become so inflated unconsciously that this one little look just was like sent me down to the depths. And maybe there was some sense that I was holding on to that space, holding on to that invincible state. So just the slightest look was so painful, really, and embarrassing, and I felt ashamed and embarrassed. So when I think back of that, it's not anything that I was even doing. That's why the memory of it stands out. It's like, what was that? And I think it's just this sense of like, nothing can bother me. And then the slightest little thing bothered me a little bit, and that was enough to just feel like devastated. Because if something could bother me a little bit, then like, who knows what comes next? And of course, lots came next. I got much more bothered than that between that time and today. But, so what is this like embarrassment and shame and guilt? So looking into what the different psychologists say about this, sometimes it's said that this is a somewhat agreed upon modern comparison of terms. There's no definitive definitions of these different terms, but there's some agreement these days that people are using guilt, the word guilt, for something that we do, some action that we do that we actually don't feel good about. And generally like a kind of like something that's like ethically questionable, meaning maybe that's even already too loaded to say that, like precepts and commandments and stuff. Maybe just the sense of like we're doing something that's harmful to others. I think that's what ethical means, you know, being conscious of not harming others. So, and we can feel guilty about doing something that's comes from our sense of separation from others, and therefore is creating more sense of separation or harm towards others, and we feel guilty about that. And I know that guilt can be like a kind of a loaded term, but I think in this case, guilt was kind of a positive thing. Maybe a better, less loaded word would be conscience. Conscience, I think, we don't think of as a burdensome negative quality of mind. Just the natural feeling we have about maybe even natural ethics, like the ways we really feel like, well, everyone would agree that this is like harmful and separating from this person across all cultures, you know. And then that sense of conscience, or another word sometimes gets used in the Buddha Dharma is self-respect. That's, I think, that sounds very different from guilt, even though sometimes the definitions sound similar. Self-respect is like, I want to live in accord with all beings and non-separation and non-harm. And because of this sense of self-respect, I feel kind of not so good if I go against that. And but it's about the action. It's not about me as the person. It's just about something that I did. And therefore, I can actually change what I did, or at least regret what I did and resolve to try not to fall into that sense of separation next time. In classic Buddhist teachings, foundational Buddhism, the Buddha taught these two qualities of mind, in Sanskrit called Hri Apatrapya. Hri is, maybe in this sense we could say guilt, but that's, I don't think that's quite right. Conscience or self-respect is Hri, and Apatrapya is concern about what others think. Or maybe fear of blame. Maybe that's a little too heavy. Maybe we could say conscience and concern. This is how one person translates these two terms. Conscience is more like, I don't feel so good myself, I don't care what anybody else thinks, but I know I feel like this is, I'd like to do better. And the concern for others is more like, well, I actually do care what they think on some basic level. And the Buddha said these two qualities of mind are qualities of every wholesome consciousness. Every wholesome state of mind has these two. Some sense of self-respect or conscience, or feeling regret if we're going against others, you know, or harming others, separating ourselves, and caring what others think, because they keep our conduct wholesome. The Buddha even said, these are the two guardians or protectors of the world. These two mental states are the guardians of the world. It's beautiful, I think. And sometimes I've seen these translated as like shame and dread, for example. So I think you just have to be careful what we mean by them. I think from tonight's discussion, I would not use the word shame again for Hri. Because these modern psychologists generally use the word guilt for this feeling of regret about some action that we've done. And shame is about more like that I am actually bad. Maybe the brief version is guilt is I did something bad. Shame is I am bad. little difference, but huge difference. Yeah. And in that sense, so-called guilt, or we could say conscience, is a wholesome quality of mind, whereas shame is not so wholesome. It's kind of, that's a kind of, it drags us down into depression and alienation, maybe even addiction and separation, and kind of stuck, like we can't, we're afraid to act, maybe, if we really get into this. I am just not worthy to be here, somehow, even. One definition of shame is the fear of disconnection. Like we're unworthy of love or connection or belonging, that sense of shame. Which is different than, I just did something that hurt somebody, but I can apologize, and I regret it, or at least resolve to do better. That doesn't drag us down into this fear of disconnection. They're close, but I appreciated that definition. Shame is the fear of disconnection, feeling unworthy of connection or belonging, since I am inherently flawed. Of course, if we start thinking about it, we think, well, how could I be inherently flawed? But we do feel this way sometimes, don't we? And I think this is what shame is about. I am bad versus I did something kind of bad. And embarrassment is related to, embarrassment's maybe like a lower level of the same type of emotion. And maybe again, maybe closer to shame than guilt. And embarrassment is often defined as more about what others think than ourself. I think if we're totally alone and do something, we often don't feel that embarrassed. At least for me, I wouldn't say that. I might feel guilty or ashamed, but embarrassment usually comes up around others. And some of these psychologists say, like, it's more about social norms and expectations than ethical things. If we do something that's actually harmful, maybe embarrassing, but maybe that's more like in the realm of shame or regret, whereas embarrassment is more like we just, I don't know, like my robe's not quite adjusted right, you know, something like that. It doesn't really matter, but in a social context, I want to look just right. Like when I was growing up, also other people can, in the realm of like social psychology, they say, other people can be embarrassed for something that we did. They call it vicarious embarrassment. And it's kind of like, I think it generally happens when we're kind of identified with the other person. Right? If someone that we're really close to does something embarrassing, then we get kind of embarrassed. But sometimes it could be just, you know, we're in an airport or something and somebody kind of stumbles and we go, oh, you know, we even say, oh, excuse me, or oh, like we feel almost a little, catch a little moment of embarrassment with somebody else sort of tripping on as they're walking. And I think in a way that's kind of a cool thing, because I think it just shows how connected we are. They say, sometimes say the ones who feel most of this vicarious embarrassment are the ones who have the most empathy for others, so they can really feel embarrassed with somebody else's faux pas. In a way it shows our connection, but in another way I think it shows our entanglement and ensnarlment. I was thinking of growing up, like my dad would sometimes like just, you know, when he was in a really good mood, he'd just walk down the street and start like singing a random song and making up his own words. And like when my brother and I were little, my brother especially would say, "Dad, stop it, don't do that." Kind of like, people will think you're weird. So it's like he got a little embarrassed about my dad. You know. And then a little later, when I was in my full on, hippie phase, and I wouldn't cut my hair or beard for years, and they just got longer and longer. And so my dad, was, then the roles got reversed. My dad would get kind of embarrassed about me. Like, couldn't you, you don't really want to look that way, do you? I'm like, I think you don't want to look that way, Dad. But actually, that's what I'm choosing. And again, it's like we can get shamed into something like looks like that or something about what other people think. Both shame and guilt, which is a more ethical thing. I mean, embarrassment, which is a more social thing, and guilt, which is a more ethical thing. I think both of them can slowly grow into actual shame. Like we feel like if Dad says that enough, like you look really messy because your hair's too long or something, then we can start to really take it on and start to really feel, maybe I am actually flawed. And I mean, I could cut it, but maybe I can't even cut it at this point. So I think it's a big topic that we all deal with. And I think that when I think about these way we're defining here, that this self-respect or conscience could operate without a strong sense of fixed self or separate self. That's why the Buddha says, as practitioners, these are wholesome mind states. You don't have to hold a strong view of you as a separate self to have this sense of conscience or maybe even guilt, the way we're talking about it. But the shame is definitely based on a strong sense of independent self that is fundamentally flawed on top of that. On top of being a separate self, it's like a flawed separate self. And so that's like, that drags us down, it's very painful. And embarrassment, I think, is also kind of based on a sense of a separate self. So I got embarrassment, guilt, and shame when the sense of self starts creeping in and solidifying those natural emotions. So what do we do when we notice these? One thing is just, I think our practice often tells us, just pay attention, be aware of these things when they're happening. Be aware of the growing sense of like not good enough and so on. The messages and the expectations from ourselves and others that drive and fuel shame, we can start investigating these messages and expectations, like the messages of like, you know, you really should be ashamed to like be growing your hair so long, something like this, is like, well, we can examine that. Is there something actually wrong with growing hair long? It's maybe just my dad's cultural thing, you know? And maybe it's actually okay. Or maybe there is something wrong. We can check it out. That's like a message that we're getting. Or an expectation we might have for ourselves, like, I should be better. And then, since we're Zen practitioners, I think all of this, all of these messages and expectations about being better, being perfect, being flawless, are just woven into Zen practice, for better or worse. They creep in there. We hear about the Buddha, right? The greatly awakened one. We hear about unsurpassed perfect enlightenment, right? We chant these things all the time. And so we think like, I should be that way. Especially if we've been practicing for a long time. The expectations are even greater for ourselves. Maybe other people can put that on us, and we put it on us too. And if we start getting special robes and stuff like this, the expectations from both others and from oneself can get higher and higher and more unrealistic. Something we don't necessarily fall into, but I think to some degree we just have to pay attention to this, because we maybe fall into it in small ways, if not large. So what is it that we really want? We might say, well, I just heard about this enlightenment thing. I don't even know what it means. But all I know is that if you've been practicing a long time, you should have it. Something like that. Even unconsciously, we might think like this. Or say, I do know what it means being totally selfless all the time and never acting selfishly or harmfully. And then we have these ideals. I have these ideals. And then we set them up, and if we're not living in accord with them, we could feel either this, self-respect and regret that we miss, and then we so-called confess and repent and resolve to pick up the practice again maybe we can do that without any self-judgment at all. I think that's when practice can really work. But it often gets mixed in with this self-judgment. Either I can't do it, I keep trying and I'm not making any progress, so I must be flawed. This kind of thought. Others around me seem to be doing so much better. Why can't I practice like they do? And secretly, they're thinking the same thing about you. This often happens if we started comparing notes, mind notes. So what do we really need? What do we really want? Why are we even practicing in the first place? And what about others' expectations of us? That maybe, again, the longer we practice, the more others have expectations of us too. Like we think, Kokyo, if you're the teacher at the Zen Center, you should be this, 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 this. And then I'd be like, oh yeah, I guess they're right. And maybe they are, and it's, in a way, that's, could be a valuable age to practice, to be in such a role, because people keep trying to help me live the way according to my vow, right? But it can also seep in there and be like, I'll never live up to the expectations of others or myself. Can we really be authentic? Often another thing that happens when we feel ashamed, we might not notice that it comes from this, but this is what the psychologists sometimes say, is when we feel the pain of shame, we tend to then blame others. When I heard that, I thought, yeah, I really see how that's true. And without having consciously thinking about that, I might have thought, what's the connection between shame for myself and blaming others? But check it out, right? Check out how we do that, because it feels so painful to feel that lack or shame or unworthiness ourselves. We try to bolster up our sense of self-worth by putting something lack, put our lack onto somebody else. It's called blame. So it can be really toxic, shame, this unconscious shame. So here's a Zen story. This is case 28 in the Book of Serenity, called Huguo's Three Embarrassments. Huguo's Three Embarrassments. Huguo's Three Embarrassments. A monk asked, Hu Guo, the Zen teacher, how is it when a crane stands on a withered pine? So these are kind of these poetic Zen images for like total graceful equanimity and ease. Just, can you picture the poetic image? How is it when an elegant crane at sunset is perched on a withered pine, just like in the Chinese painting? The crane stands so still and gracefully balanced there, right? On this withered pine adds to the imagery of like, it's very cool, and there's no inflamed, excessiveness with this kind of pine. So it's kind of like, we could hear this as the monk saying, when my practice is like an elegant crane perched on a withered pine, how is it then, teacher? And the teacher, Hu Guo, says, an embarrassment on the ground below. And we could hear it as those of us looking up at you, perched there, describing how elegant you are up there, us down here are kind of embarrassed for you. We could hear it like that. Could also hear it like, when you eventually fall off that branch, which might be when the next scornful look flashes at you, you might fall right off the branch to the ground below, and then you'll be pretty embarrassed too, that you were like, kind of stuck up there on a withered pine. How is it when a crane stands on a withered pine? And the teacher says, an embarrassment on the ground below. Maybe if it's not so exalted, if it's just like, well, hey, I'm just like a bird resting on a branch for a while. I'm not like a crane on a withered pine. Then it's not so embarrassing. We just get up and fly away, right? But if I'm a crane on a withered pine, then when I fall to the ground, it's muddy down here. In fact, I broke my thin little leg falling off the branch. The branch fell on, the withered branch broke. So, the monk again asked, well, how is it when a drop of water is frozen into pure crystalline ice? Just another image for the same type of thing. This messy drop of water that keeps splattering all over the place when it gets really, really cool from sitting on a withered pine for a long time. It can get so cool that it just freezes into unmoving stillness, perfectly clear and unmoving. How is it when a drop of water is frozen into this pure ice? And the teacher says, an embarrassment when the sun comes out. In one of the commentaries on this case, I think a modern commentary, it said sometimes if you're doing this in koan practice, one of the kind of checking follow-up questions, sometimes they have extra questions around each koan. One of the questions is, what is the sun? It's an embarrassment when the sun comes out, if you're a frozen drop of water. What is the sun that makes you start sweating and dripping and lose the pure stillness? And then the monk asked again, at the time of the purge of the Buddha Dharma in the 840s. This is in old China, the 840s in the Tang Dynasty, was when there was one of these purges of Buddhism, which periodically happened in China and happened, I think, with most religions around the world periodically. There was the emperor was basically like, didn't like Buddhism. The emperor was Taoist. And you know, Taoism and Buddhism and Confucianism, like, all practiced harmoniously for many, many centuries and still do today in China. But at that time, this emperor was maybe a little bit narrow-minded and thought, like, I know all these past emperors were into all three of these kind of religions, but Buddhism is like a kind of Indian religion. It's not native to our noble culture. It's a barbarian religion from the West. I think this has happened, you know. I think still sometimes some Chinese are more proud of Taoism and Confucianism because their founders were native to their country. Buddha is from somewhere else. It's kind of a outsider. So this emperor's like, we're into Taoism, let's get rid of Buddhism. Let's get rid of it. Let's build a wall. Which, you know, I don't know if it was, that probably wasn't this emperor, but some emperors did build walls in China, right? Great walls that were very high and long. So the monk asks, at the time, this was like a couple centuries earlier, when Buddhism was purged, and later it revived itself, of course. But the monk asks, at the time of the purge of Buddhism in the 840s, where did the good spirits, the Dharma protectors, go at that time? So this is like right outside the window there. You can see Ida Songten, our temple Dharma protector. He protects the temple from purges and evil forces, and protects the Dharma from disappearance. The Dharma can start getting eroded by like false views, right, and misunderstandings and so on. So Dharma protectors protect the place, and they protect the Dharma, and they protect the practitioners. So the temples have these Dharma protectors at the entrance gates in China. And the monk asks, at the time when the Buddha Dharma was destroyed, or was kind of, when the emperor tried to wipe it out in the 840s, where did those good spirits who are the Dharma protectors go at that time? Why didn't they protect it, in other words, right? And teacher Hu Bo said, an embarrassment for those protectors at the temple gate. This one has a slightly different flavor than the first two questions, right? It's kind of like, why don't all those Dharma protectors keep the Dharma always pure and fresh and alive? We might even say that we are the Dharma protectors too, right? As practitioners, we join forces with Ida Songten there and say our job is to protect the Dharma by sitting Zazen and by discussing the teachings together and so on. So both the statues at the temple gate and the practitioners, these Dharma protectors, where did they go when Buddhism got almost wiped out? Why couldn't they protect it? And the teacher says, it's an embarrassment for those Dharma protectors at the temple gate. So here we could also see it as this feel this like feeling this obligation to protect the Dharma through our practice. I think it's, you know, it's a wholesome intention to feel like we should uphold and protect the Dharma as practitioners. But for one thing, it's not, the Dharma is not something that we can actually protect, and the Dharma is something that in its deepest sense doesn't need our protection. Like in this example of the story of the emperor, the Taoist emperor, you know, they were the Taoists in those days were into like immortality, and they had these elixirs of immortality, and one of them was cinnabar. You know, they would actually like mix these potions of gold, and cinnabar is this red mineral. It's kind of a sacred mystical mineral for the Chinese Taoists, but it's basically the crude form of mercury. So they would like mix up these brews of molten gold and mercury, and they were very valuable substances, so only people like the emperors could drink them, and the emperors are the ones who get to be immortal first. This is true story. So they would drink these, and so I think the story was something like after the emperor kind of like purging Buddhism meant like all the monks and nuns, he made them return to lay life, meaning like we don't want any full-time practitioners around here. That makes the Dharma too strong. So just go back. Of course they could keep practicing. Of course they did, right? They didn't forget the Dharma, but the outer form of Buddhism, like the monasteries and all, weren't functioning, and the buildings got destroyed. But the Dharma kept going, of course. It can't be, the Dharma can never be wiped out. But while the emperor thought that he wiped it out, then he's like, cool, I did that, now let's just drink some elixir and be immortal. So, and a year later he died. And as soon as he died, the next emperor was like, that was kind of harsh, let's bring this Buddhism, we love Buddhism, it's been in our country for centuries, let's bring it back. And they did. So there's a sort of a nice sub-story in this culture, in this story of how the, if we try to destroy something out of arrogance and narrow-mindedness, we only harm ourselves. And apparently this, the commentary says when Buddha Dharma arose again a year later, it got much stronger. It flourished even more. So that's actually an embarrassment, supreme embarrassment for the emperor. Doesn't mention that. But the fact that the Dharma protectors couldn't prevent this temporary year-long purge, it's kind of an embarrassment for the Dharma protectors because they thought that they were supposed to do it. It's kind of, again, I think all these forms of embarrassment are when we're holding a sense of a separate self. Then we can get into embarrassment, and then it can increase into shame. A separate self that should be like an elegant crane on a withered pine, like a messy drop of water in a crystal clear, unmoving ice drop. A strong Dharma protector that will never let the Dharma get eroded. All these are like a little bit too much, holding a little bit too much personal self, and therefore when they fail, they're embarrassing. So maybe the bottom line is got to be careful not to take any of it too seriously. But if we go too far to the other extreme and take it too unseriously, then we start to feel that sense of, we lose our sense of self-respect then, right? Because there's something beautiful we want to keep alive. So there's some thoughts on guilt, shame, and embarrassment. Questions, yes?
Well, couldn't you say that, like when I'm thinking about the Dharma protectors, I mean, in a way, it was maybe something that could invite some humility. And also just pointing out our imperfection. I mean, I know that's the thing I like to talk about, but it's because it's part of our human nature. And so, in a way, there's nothing wrong with being embarrassed.
Mm.
There's nothing wrong with being embarrassed. I mean, I definitely agree that, you know, shame is toxic. But in the story, in the context of these stories, I mean, it's kind of just like if I was a Dharma protector, I'm sorry. I wasn't able to protect the Buddhism from the misguided emperor. And I'm sorry about that. And I'm kind of embarrassed because I'm a Dharma protector. You know, that there's something almost kind of sweet and noble about that. It doesn't have to be a sad story.
It is a natural thing, and I think you're right that shame is we're talking about shame as toxic because it's a strong sense of self-deprecation in it. Whereas embarrassment is a little bit more lighthearted.
It's also like, you know, well, I want to do well and I don't do well, and so I'm just noticing that when I don't, maybe there's a little embarrassment.
I guess the way I've been thinking of it is that's more like this sense of self-respect and even the sense of guilt of like, I messed up and I've resolved to do better, a little regret maybe.
Yeah.
And so we could use embarrassment that way too, but at like this point about embarrassment in the psychology world being more connected with like social expectations, I think is an interesting point because we invest a lot in social expectations, and that's not something bad either. That's partly how society dependently arises. But I think it's worth questioning a lot of social expectations. I think that was the beauty of the shift in our country from the 50s into the 60s. There was a massive questioning of social norms, right? And we're like, wait a second, we're feeling a little bit like squelched by our culture, and it's nothing more than our culture. It's not, these are not ethical issues. And we have to be careful, we have to like watch that line where it turns from like a culture, some cultural values are based on ethical issues, and some aren't. They're just styles that change as the times change, and how to like tease that apart. And I think the embarrassment often goes more with this somewhat silly social things. And I think there's a lot of Zen stories that some of these Zen ancestors did some things that we might think of as like pretty embarrassing, like intentionally, to kind of like some of them would like, you know, when they're cold at night, they're like, I'm cold, so like we need some firewood. There's none sitting around except for the Buddha on the altar there. So how would we burn that to stay warm? Like, talk about embarrassing for a Buddhist monk to burn their icon just to stay warm for themselves for just an hour until it's burned up. A small statue, maybe even 10 minutes. So in that way, I think they're pushing the edges. We might say, that's actually really disrespectful. It didn't belong to that monk. But I think the story is powerful because it's saying that the center of the religion is actually just a cultural, idea. And it's so offensive to think about burning a Buddha statue that that story made it into the Zen collections for centuries because it pushes our sense of well, is that ethically problematic? And we think, well, maybe not. As long as the donors who gave the statue weren't too offended. But sometimes the Zen ancestors intentionally offended and embarrassed their donors to point out attachments. Yes.
I was going to say there's sort of an interesting intersection between acceptance of kind of what is. I think, I don't know, I guess coming from the point of view of someone that dealt with depression a lot and sort of what's the genesis of that. And there's this sort of comparison of what either you think you're supposed to be doing or what other people are
yes.
doing. And you go, well, they're, you know, look what they've done with their life.
Yes.
You know, oh my God, I'm just, you know, this schlunk.
Comparison.
Yeah, so comparison mm-hmm. is a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
That this is this sort of self-imposed, like
yeah.
you've got this idea about what you are supposed to be. And
it can yes.
be based on expectations that your parents had.
Yep.
And
expectations of from ourself or others.
Or mm-hmm. others, yeah. So it's sort of, it can be sort of social, kind of based on that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I guess I just, for me, I just kind of, the older I get, the more, I mean, like I think the midlife crisis for a lot of people is that point where,
yeah.
oh my God, this is all I've done with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
mm-hmm.
you realize that there's this sort of limited time going forward.
Totally.
And then you had all these ideas about what you were supposed to be.
I was going to be president of the U.S.
mm-hmm. The best, you know, mm-hmm. practitioner.
Yep, yep, totally.
Be enlightened by now.
Exactly.
So I just feel like sort of practice seems to be, there's a certain level of this kind of acceptance
yes,
of what is.
Totally.
Also, just kind of care for this being, like sort of stepping back, like, okay, there's all these causes and conditions that
mm-hmm.
created this
mm-hmm.
persona.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's all it is.
Out of my control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, all of them were.
Yeah. Right.
All we are is causes and conditions, and there's nobody controlling them. There's no additional self besides the causes and conditions, and there's no additional self that's controlling the causes and conditions. So that's, yeah, and that's starting to approach the so-called enlightenment that I was trying to actually get for myself, ironically. And I think you're so right with the midlife crisis thing, you know, because I think I'm around that age.
Well, you become very reflective and you kind of look
yeah,
back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I made these decisions, mm-hmm. these different intersections.
Yep, they led to a certain way, and it can feel like too late to take some other paths at some point.
Yeah.
It can feel that way. And then to really open to that and accept that, yeah. And it's beautiful practice. And it has a lot to do with this. I think this story is a lot like that. Is like without going to one extreme, there isn't this painful kind of embarrassment or shameful embarrassment at the other extreme when we just surrender to the bigger picture
and find compassion
for ourselves. And therefore compassion for others and less blame towards others because everyone's in the same boat that's sinking. Yeah, last question, I think.
Well, I just wanted to express appreciation for how you've taken a koan that I think would be a little inaccessible and difficult to unpack and then blended it with something really accessible that we all really can relate to. And I just really enjoyed that.
Thank you. I wanted to say the comment on embarrassment on the ground below. There's a verse comments for that line. The comment there is letting go of every state of mind is hard. Well, since I'm lucky that Nettie expressed some appreciation, otherwise I could feel terribly ashamed of this talk.
That's why I did it. I was worried.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, sometimes though we can feel really good about a talk and then, you know, we record them and you go back and listen and be like, that was awful. Or feel really bad about it and go back and listen, that was great. It's totally random. Yeah. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.